Welcome to Courage Cocktail, and I'm your host, Leanne McClymont. Glad you could join us today. We're broadcasting a Halloween-flavored Courage Cocktail today as we prepare for the Halloween festivities next Wednesday. Kids, trick-or-treating, candy corn, and of course, costume parties galore this weekend. As we blend your Courage Cocktail today, we will be talking about a ghost story. And did I mention that it's a ghost story that's all about a witch? Oh, we're gonna have fun. Here's the background. Imagine a cold winter and a desperate place called Salem Town. The year is 1692. Then there are three people first accused and arrested for witchcraft. They all share a similar profile, outcast women. Now clearly, it's not just men and but women and men who are both accused of witchcraft during this period of American history. With us today are two authors who have worked to create a trilogy of books that challenges commonly held beliefs surrounding the Salem witch trials. Please join me today as I announce each guest. There are three people joining us today. First, Jack Heath. Jack Heath is co-author of the book Salem Six. With us also is John Thompson, who is joining us through the program, and he will be speaking after Jack, and a third voice will be Sherry Wikolowski, a frequent guest to Courage Cocktail, who helps us understand the process of building a book. I'd like to welcome you all today to Courage Cocktail.
Great to be with you, Leanne.
Okay, thank you. Now, Jack, I'm going to start off with you. Jack, could you please tell us about the book, how you wrote it, and why the story matters so much to you?
Growing up as a young boy, I was made aware that my Heath bloodline is a direct descendancy of Rebecca Nurse, who was the 19th person accused and hanged of witchcraft on July 19th in 1692. And through my great-grandfather Heath, who married Caroline Putnam Newhall, that the Putnam family were also ancestors of mine, where we grew up in next to Salem, Massachusetts. So I had, you know, just a heightened awareness and hearing as a kid my grandparents and parents talk about Rebecca Nurse, and whether it was in a whimsical or serious way, and just sort of the whole history of where we grew up and the puritanical forces that probably are still at work. And so it just always was in my head, and I thought there'd be a neat story to write someday, and using a lot of the history that I still love and respect that makes Salem unique and early Americana and New England, and also the whole witch trials, which always were perplexing to me because of the hypocrisy of the whole paranoia and, you know, the fact that these judges in this small town, even though there were a lot of forces at work, could actually come together and believe that a 71-year-old great-grandmother who was respected in the community could be an evil satanic witch. So I kind of, Rebecca Rises in our book that John and I created and wrote, and she kind of, you know, comes back to the present day, and it was a lot of fun, but to me it's, you know, it's just part of my growing up.
Now, when you said to our listeners and to me about growing up with this history, did you always have a doubt that just maybe, there's more to this story than meets the eye?
I also had a disdain to the whole thing, to be honest with you, Leanne. I never really, as a kid, really liked Halloween that much. There's a lot of hypocrisy in Salem. I respect the history. I'm glad that our book is doing so well. By the way, on Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, you can go to the main website, Salem Witch Trilogy, and one of your guest, Sherry, keeps the site up to date with paranormal and news, so it's more of a media channel for our book. But growing up in Salem, you have to understand, Leanne, and you did a great introduction for your listeners.
Thank you.
In America and in Europe, wherever around the world you are, the Salem police cruisers growing up had a witch on a broomstick as the emblem. I played sports in Swampscott High School against the Salem Witches. Mm-hmm. The Halloween, there's 250,000 people that come from all over the world to feed on this whole witch hysteria. And I don't I don't begrudge the city of Salem for making money on this at all. I'm a free market person, but the whole hypocrisy about these people who were dragged out of their homes over land disputes or just grudge matches or power grabs and the paranoia of them being evil and then being, you know, tortured, and if you didn't confess, you were hanged and buried in a mass grave, and they still haven't found the grave today. A question that I keep raising, why isn't there a bigger effort to finally put this to bed after 320 years and let these souls and spirits have the Christian burial they deserve? So to me, I always had a love-hate with the whole Salem witch history, and I love the book, I love the story, love the characters. A lot of them are family names of mine, but the whole thing, there's a lot of questions to this day.
Those questions, Jack, really challenge what may have been a rich patina of Salem history. And one of the things that's noticeable as you read this book is that your viewpoint, and the protagonist's viewpoint, I should say, represents a person who is related on both sides of this tricky issue. He is related to the Putnams as well as the nurses. So could you explain how carrying those two bloodlines truly influences the shape of this book?
Well, my nature, I'm an inquisitive person. I was in television news media for 17 years or more, I don't know, and I still do a radio show like yourself. I always question, I look, I understand there's injustice, I understand that things aren't perfect. I get the fact that there's always a couple sides to a story, and I get the fact that back in Salem, whether it was cold weather or Native Indian American attacks or famine and disease, it was a pretty tough place. I recently visited Nathaniel Hawthorne's original homestead, who's a great American early novelist, who's one of my favorite writers, and he's in the book in Salem 6, Rebecca's Rising, and, you know, there was no heat. I mean,
no heat.
In our neck of the woods, we're getting ready for colder temperatures. Imagine a January, February in the ocean, living on the Atlantic Ocean in Salem with all these forces, people hungry, and you wonder if you're going to get attacked at night, and your house is, eight degrees below zero. So I'm sure a lot of crazy stuff went on, and I don't want to play the judge. I just have a lot of fun with these characters in the book, because the Salem witch trials fascinates people to this day of all ages. People have heard about it. There's some context, whether they visited Salem, they read about it, they read about the Crucible by Arthur Miller, there's some touchstone in their life, or there's just the imagination of paranormal beyond this world forces that I think will always be there. It's just a great example of judicial extremism before we were even a country. So to me, it wasn't so much the cross bloodlines, it was just the fascination of what happened and maybe questions that still linger.
And fortunately, those lingering questions are getting a great deal of attention. This book is selling. You're getting a lot of media attention because it's a real first hand experience of, wait a minute, what happened 320 years ago? And I get the sense that you're kind of trying to right the ship here.
Well, first of all, kudos. John Thompson's a tremendous suspense writer. I know he's joining you later in the program. He brought a story that I created in my head to a lot of suspenseful life. Writing a ship, most people who've written about the Salem witch trials, like Lois Duncan wrote a great book about Gallows Hill, and that's a book I'd recommend to your readers, your listeners. But most books deal with trying to write something in the tense of 200 or 300 years ago. What I wanted to do was say, okay, what if this never stopped? What if there's a coven or a cult that's still going on today with the most prominent families behind the scenes? What if this thing never really stopped? Oh, and by the way, what if it wasn't what we thought it was? What if the whole thing was something else? And that's what's fun about the book. That's what's fun about. Now, do I get a kick as a descendant of Rebecca Nurse, of her, excuse my French, coming back to kick a little butt? Yeah. I mean, I think that this woman was snatched out of her home. Her son secretly, you know, in the late 1800s, went back and had to unearth his mother from the mass grave, probably by horse and cart, take her to their farm in Danvers and rebury her. in a proper Christian burial. I mean, this. So I, yeah, I look it. I'm already considered in Salem. I think you can. Thank you for your nice words. The book is doing very well. We're getting a lot of attention. Readers like it. They can't wait for the sequel that's coming out. We don't want to promise when, but coming out soon. Mm-hmm. The story has legs. It raises questions, but most of all, it entertains. But I don't mind being known as the guy who's related to these people, who's asking a few questions, and if it ruffles feathers, I don't care.
Well, now you hold on to that thought and ruffled feathers, because we want to move right along into the suspenseful storytelling and writing of the extremely gifted author John Thompson. John, you're on the line with us. Welcome to Courage Cocktail.
Thank you very much, Leanne.
Well, John, I'm so fortunate to have both Jack and John in the same line, in the same space, so you were able to hear his comments. But John, before you even talk about the book, I want to talk a little bit about you. You have a wonderful website. It's called www.booksbyjohnthompson.com. You have several books coming out, many of which are coming out now and then again in the spring 2013. And I'm sure we'll have a moment to talk about them. But one of the things that I'd like you to share with our listeners is, what was your fascination behind Jack's story? And what was it that made you build this suspense thriller?
For me, the fun of it was, I have no baggage that relates to Salem or to having people in my family that were dragged in their homes and hung, but it's an incredible story. It smacks of things going on all around the world around us. Fortunately, today not in the United States, but this stuff still happens. And to be able to hear it from Jack and to think about it and to think about, all right, you have our main character, John Edwards, is a somewhat jaundiced ex TV guy who's become the executive editor of a small paper in Salem. And he hates this portrait that hangs on the wall of his house because it's this grumpy-looking old Puritan woman we've all seen those portraits, you know, high collar, dour expression, looks like it would break her mouth to smile. And that has hung it by a promise to his aunt who gave him the house. That picture has to hang in the house. It's a family heirloom, and that happens to be a picture of Rebecca Nurse. And he walks downstairs one morning, a little hungover, and sees that the picture has been moved from the place that he keeps it, which is out of sight in the living room, to a prominent place right over his mantle where he can't miss it. And he wonders whatever induced him to have moved the picture in a drunken stupor the night before. And from there, Rebecca Nurse inserts herself into his life in a way that makes him think he's going mad at first, and makes him then a very reluctant believer that she is bringing him into something that relates in deep ways to his family and to his community. And in the sequels to the book, we'll find out it's bigger than that. But It's a fun story, and one that has a lot of legs, I think.
Well, you know, one of those legs, beyond the exciting pace of a thriller and beyond the, you know, spectral nature of the ending of this book or throughout the book, but there's a real pragmatic vein here, and that's the thread of avarice. Can you explore that with our listeners?
Well, in reality, back in the days of Salem, a lot of what was perhaps, I think it's unproved, but it's the circumstantial evidence is very powerful. A lot of the people who were involved in accusing members of their community of being witches were then able to seize their property and became quite wealthy. One of the people in particular was the sheriff of Salem, whose brother, by the way, was also one of the judges who judged these people. And what they would do is when they arrested someone on the suspicion of being a witch, you were asked to confess. Either you could confess guilty or you could say you were innocent. Only upon confession could you be tried. If you didn't confess, then they had to leave you alone at some point.
So
in order to extract a confession, however, there was a very unpleasant process of there was something that they did called pressing. And there was one very famous story of a man who was accused of being a witch. He was taken into a farm field, stripped naked. Boards were put across his chest, and members of the community placed really large stones on those boards and left them there. And every few hours or whatever, they would add some more stones, more rocks. And he held out and managed to not confess, either innocent or guilty, until he died. So I guess you can say that if you were arrested, you were probably in, you know, really serious trouble. They hung 19 people, hung or pressed to death, and I guess some were found innocent. But you certainly had this suspicion that, and when you were found guilty, all of your property was forfeit, and the sheriff got half of it.
Now,
so,
now when
it was
you
a
say
great deal for the sheriff.
Oh yeah, we've identified motive here. I just can't help but marvel that the onlookers didn't feel threatened by this form of avarice. You know, clearly,
I think they might have, but you know, hysteria is a very, very powerful thing in any community.
Mm-hmm.
And what Jack just described is, you know, Salem was a place, when you walked out the door of your house at night in Salem, if you lived over the hill from the center of town, you didn't see a light anywhere. You were you might have been the only person on the face of the earth. You'd come across a cold, dark ocean to help build a small colony. It was riddled with disease. Your crops were failing. You were attacked by Indians. You must have really felt, I mean, everyone in that colony must have felt at some point that they'd made a really bad choice. And so the fear that maybe a lot of them came over very, very specifically for rigid doctrinal religious reasons, they all must have wondered at some point whether they were wrong, whether God didn't like them anymore. And our book, in fact, goes into a whole counter idea about why the Salem witchcraft trials might have occurred and what underlying motive might be there that no one's ever suspected. It's fictional, but it's fun.
Well, it's a lot of fun, and it's very fast-moving. And Jack Heath, who's also on the line, I know you've heard John describe these processes and his context of writing history, and not writing history, but perhaps rewriting history. But I wonder sometimes, Jack, if you could describe for our listeners how you felt when you realized that the motive of seizing property may have been a conspiracy, and it may indeed have a really leave a nasty aftertaste in people whose families and lines are still prominent in that region and nationally.
Well, I don't know if I felt at a particular time on any one thing. Much of what John just described historically is accurate, and he was referring to Giles Corey, the man who was pressed in the field, and a lot of these people who were hanged never confessed of the 19. They were quoting Scripture and God when they were going to the gallows. But I don't think I ever felt at one point, because of one Reverend Samuel Parris, for example, who was a suspect in my mind. He was the one of the co-accusers with the Putnam girls, you know, and John was right. One thing he didn't mention, that if you were accused, your land, everything he described was right on the money, but you were also excommunicated from the church. And back then, going to a Sunday service was probably your one saving grace of the week, no pun intended. I just always thought that there was just, I can't think of a better word, maybe John can, but an hypocrisy about the whole thing. I also marveled that for such a famous chapter in early American history, that the only real defining piece on what happened was Arthur Miller's The Crucible, and what one of us didn't have a high school play or a junior high school play where The Crucible or his play was part of your school, and it was just kind of, to me, begging for modern-day review or exam And you know, there's, you know, when Dan Brown wrote the Da Vinci Code, I'm sure the Roman, the Catholic Church wasn't thrilled. I think they're still in Salem, Mass, and I've run into it. Some very well-intentioned people, but still waters run deep, and there's still some sentiment, maybe guilt, almost like, you know, just leave it alone. Just leave it alone. Don't ask questions. And I don't mean to keep underscoring this because I come and go from this point, but as a descendant, if you were to ask me, Leanne, what one thing really irks you and bugs you and drives you when you maybe get tired of writing or your creative energy needs a recharge, is it bugs me that there's a memorial in the center of the city of Salem, a very nice memorial, by the way, that was just rededicated this summer for the victims. There's also a memorial in Rebecca Nurse's homestead in neighboring Danvers, because Salem Town back then used to be a larger geography than city proper, now Salem. But at Gallows Hill, where history knows that somewhere on or at that, which is now a park, so picture a Little League field, a parking lot, and a soccer field in this hill with a water tower on the hill. And by the way, I kid you not, big water tower like any municipality, there's a big painted black witch and a broomstick right on the water tower today as we speak, overlooking the field where these people were hanged as witches, that they don't know where the grave is. And Pat LaMarche of the Huffington Post recently wrote a piece about this, that I just think that bugs me. That bugs me more than that. There should be closure and a place for saying, here lie the innocent souls who were accused of witchcraft in 1692, may God rest their souls. So some kind of thing, and I think would actually enhance the tourism experience. And I'm not one of these self-righteous preacher types. But that as a descendant bugs me.
Well, and I believe me, this just learning, seeing this landscape, both the landscape of 1692 and the landscape of the current book, where you're writing it in current time. And the protagonist, John Andrews, makes his way through the plot. I can understand your feelings. Now, I want to return to John. John, I know we're here to talk about Salem 6, but I cannot ignore your gifts as a writer. And I want to know if you could just tell our listeners a little bit about all the other delightful books you have coming out.
Well, thank you. A couple of years ago, I wrote a book called Armageddon Conspiracy. It was my first published novel, and it was a finalist for Best Fiction with the Southern Independent Booksellers. I live in Charleston, South Carolina, but I was very proud of that. And it also won the Independent Publishers Gold Medal as Best Thriller of the Year nationally. Salem 6 is my second novel, written with Jack, and just released is the first sequel to Armageddon Conspiracy. It's called The Hong Kong Deception, and it's out right now in ebook. It will be out as an ebook for 90 days, and then there will be print editions available. We're doing the release just the same as we did it with Salem 6. And following that, in November, we're going to release the next sequel to Armageddon Conspiracy, which is called The Baghdad Vendetta. It has the same character, Brent Lucas, all the way through, and they really are fun stories. They've got lots of action, again, the first book was a finalist for Best Fiction by the Southern Independent Booksellers, so I guess I can say it's got some critical acclaim, and my agent thinks that the second two are better. So those are my adult thrillers. In addition to that, we will have two sequels coming of Salem 6. The first sequel probably will be out late spring or summer.
Hold on. I have to interrupt you. Jack Heath, did you hear that? He's taking a risk out there.
Then I have a middle grade novel. It's my first middle grade novel coming with HarperCollins at the end of April. It's called The Girl from Felony Bay. And it's also a mystery, but it involves two 12-year-old protagonists, two girls who solve a modern-day mystery and a mystery of finding a Confederate blockade runner gold hoard, and they right some wrongs, and it's set down in the South.
Well, it sounds like you've been busy. You've been writing a lot.
I have been writing a lot.
That's great. I want you to continue because I've enjoyed both of these books. I read The Salem Six instantly, and I went back and I read the, was it the Armageddon
Conspiracy?
That's right. That's right. Because I thought Brent Lucas was an interesting character.
Well, thank you.
Now, listen, gentlemen, I'm thrilled that you're both on the line. I want you to stay put. We're going to go to soon. We're going to talk a little bit with Sherry Wikolowski. I've asked Sherry to join us today because if there's one person who can describe the anatomy of releasing a book in this current day and age, it's Sherry. And listening to her, having you online where I can ask you some questions, too, may really help our listeners understand not only who wrote the book, why they wrote the book, how they wrote the book, but how that book came into the marketplace. So stay tuned. Thank you. This election season, don't let the politicians' doom and gloom get you down. Come to the Carborough's Really, Really Free Market. That's on Saturday, November the 3rd at 2 p.m. at the Carborough Town Commons. From each according to what they don't need, to each according to what they want. Food, books, clothing, entertainment, all of it is for free. That's the Really, Really Free Market in Carborough on November the 3rd at 2 p.m. Welcome back to Courage Cocktail Radio Show. I'm your host, Leanne McClymont. You are listening to WCOM-FM. Joining me today in our studios are three guests. We're talking about the new book called Salem Six. We've invited both authors in, Jack Heath, who's joining us from Nashua, New Hampshire, and John Thompson, who's based out in Charleston, South Carolina. We're describing the history, the motivations for this book, and in this section, where we usually go into the caboose and speak to our guest with guts, we have found such a guest with guts in the book's publisher. Her name is Sherry Wikolowski. Now, for listeners, my loyal crew, you may have heard her voice before. She has been on the previous programs over the course of a year or so. But I've asked her to join us because she is able to talk about the anatomy of bringing a book to marketplace, which I think many of us in this community would be find most valuable. Welcome to the program, Sherry Wikolowski, publisher of Salem Six.
Thank you, Leanne. I'm glad to be here.
I hope you like our new studios, by the way.
I do. They're lovely.
Thank you. Made possible by the generous donations of listeners like you. Now, listen, I have asked you to come along and be prepared to talk about the preparation of a manuscript and all the steps that are involved in bringing a great book to life. And I'd like you to, can you tell us a little bit about a couple of topics that you think are critical that we should be aware of as consumers, as authors, as content creators?
Absolutely. I think one thing I'd really like to point out is that there's a team of people that have to come together to collaborate to build a book. I mean, we are actually building a product. So from the storyline to writing the book to the editorial side of it. You know, it goes through more than one edit, then going back for review and getting the book formatted from the beautiful cover design that we have, and then planning the marketing. I mean, there's a lot involved. It's not, you know, I know Jack, you know, has been formulating the stories for years and years, and then getting him together with John and you know, taking months and months and months to get the book written and going through editing and putting it all together. And while that's all in development, we're also planning on the marketing and the promotion and how are we going to launch the book. You know, we decided to launch the ebook July 19th of this year. It was the 320th anniversary of Rebecca Nurse's hanging. And so that's the date we decided to launch the ebook, and then waited about 3 months and launched the print version of the book, the hardcover and the paperback, at the end of September, and actually did a book launch in Salem, Massachusetts, which was a lot of fun, and the city rallied around it. So there's a lot that goes into it.
Now, John and Jack remain on the line, and they're being very patient listeners, and I appreciate that, gentlemen. But I'm going to continue just picking up on a thread that Sherry said, which was, this is going on all at the same time. So is Sherry, I address this to you.
Oh, absolutely. So while you know, the pre-publication team is working on the book, the editing, the story, the content, we're planning, you know, the events, the launch, and looking in advance. I mean, we're planning marketing and promotional events for 2013 already.
2013. Now, John, who's on the line, who co-authored it, John Thompson. John, I have a question for you. We know that Jack knows how the story builds. He's on the heartbeat of the storyline. Sherry's understands the mechanics of what it takes to market a book, promote a book. But I'm thinking about you, because it leaves me to feel that you might be the guy who, in this whole entire process, you know, writing, filling in the storyline, filling in the movement, was there any time where that was a little scary for you, that they're rolling out a campaign and the book hadn't been finished yet?
Well no. And the reason is that when I was asked to help with the book, I said that I needed to read it first and see it in its form at that point, because I said, if I can put this story on like a coat and it fits, then I can do this. And if I can't, if it's not the kind of story I can write, I'll know that right away. And I started reading it and I went, oh yeah, this is really, you know, there's a lot of really good stuff here. It just needs to be tuned up a little bit. So it was tons of fun writing it, because the bones of the story were wonderful.
I think that's an incredible invitation to Jack Heath. Jack, what's your take on this process now that you've done your first book, of course, with an expert crew, but you're planning the second book? How do you feel about rolling out a promotion plan when the product wasn't even finished yet?
Having been in the news business, where a lot of times you'd be doing a newscast, and when the show open was going, you're still running around behind the scenes trying to get the lead story put together. That didn't scare me. I have to just echo something Sherry said, and she's been nothing short of phenomenal. Energizer bunny of the team, leader, marketing, cutting edge. But it is a team. We all have our strengths and weaknesses, like a good sports team or any team. And I think we've gotten to know each other in a quick period of time, and that's been really exciting. The other thing is just how much all this is changing, and Sherry can speak to this better than John and myself, but as a media guy slash maybe emerging author is about as far as, you know, give myself credit.
Accomplished author.
Storyteller. Well, I think that media and how people get information, whether it's for entertainment. I mean, I look at my own wife, Patty, not too many months ago, we'd both wake up and look at a couple newspapers and have coffee and talk together at the countertop in our kitchen at the Granite, you know, the bar, and now she's on her iPad watching NFL highlights and reading something about the presidential race or commenting on something else and looking at the weather. I mean, everything's changing. So it takes a team. I recently on my radio show had the son of J.D. Salinger on my program, and it struck me, you know, the reclusive author of Catcher in the Rye living in New Hampshire right after he passed away, and his son was talking about his dad. And I don't know if the days are still there where, You know, I believe, not just because he's on the line, I think in a couple years or less, John Thompson's name will be up there as a suspense writer. You know, I mean, I loved Robert Ludlum years ago, and, you know, there's James Patterson, different kind of style, and you have John Grisham doing the legal suspense, but I think John Thompson will be right up there, and I hope to write more books, but I think gone are the days where you can just write a really good book and hope that a bookstore and some people pick it up and the world will find it. I think the whole team marketing approach, all these things happening simultaneously, it's just like getting a new TV or movie out. It has to happen that way because I don't know if you can do it alone anymore.
Well, that's an invitation to Sherry. Sherry, can you carry on? Take us to what the next phase is. I know we recognize that there's a team that puts this together. There's a great deal of faith in the work that they do and the work that you do, and a little bit of hope. But what's the next process? What else should we be thinking about bringing a book to the market?
Well, I think the most important thing is you've got to have a solid product. And Jack and John have put together a fantastic story, a fantastic book. It's incredibly well written. Go to Amazon, read the reviews time and time again. Just fantastic reviews. Even those folks who say, this may not be my cup of tea, but you know what? I still want to know what happens in the next book. When is it coming out? So from a marketing and promotional standpoint, you know, that just gives me the incredible tool to get out there and tell the world about it. So it's a constant thing. You know, it's like exercise. You can't expect to stay fit unless you're exercising every day, eating healthy. So that's kind of what marketing and promotion are for a book. So we're out there constantly trying to recreate excitement, looking for other opportunities. Obviously, we're in the Halloween season, which is lovely for us. But there's always something around the corner.
And that reminds me, folks, listeners, for those among you who heard that music tag in the beginning, it was Bach. It was his Toccata and Fugue in D minor, a classic horror piece of music. I thought it was a perfect prelude to this conversation. And I wanted to ask you, now both John Thompson and Jack and you have explained that you release these books in ebook first, meaning a Kindle book, I think, or an iBook. And then you wait a good long time for a print book. Are you willing to reveal the trade secret?
Would you like to know my secret?
Tell us your thinking behind this, because it's not obvious to me.
The thinking is really is helping to build that buzz. We need to constantly have, you know, different events, pieces of excitement. So that first, you know, 90 days in ebook gives us, you know, a slice of the pie, gives us Amazon readers, helps us to give us time to build reviews, which are so important. People buy books based on reviews and recommendations. So that gives us the time to build that. And then when the print release comes out, we've got another exciting opportunity to market. And the media loves that. If we sent everything out all at once, you know, given the title, it may not be that exciting to the media, you know, 6 months down the road. So we like to keep them guessing.
So it keeps it fresh. It keeps it alive. You capture the momentum. And you also, I think, seize a little bit of curiosity.
Exactly.
You know, once we see an ebook, it's so much easier to walk around with an ebook. And then in my experience, and gentlemen, I don't know, maybe Jack, you could help me out here. Sometimes I read a book on the Kindle and then I like it so much I want to buy it. Do you guys feel the same way, Jack?
I hope you buy it, many times. No, I'm kidding.
Okay, Jack.
Like Chicago, vote early and often. No, I'm kidding. I'm watching this. I'm learning as I go. You know what? Really, the fun thing with everyone on the call today is that it's fun to be engaged in learning, and being led sometimes by the team. And I feel that way. So I'm learning things. You know, Patty, my wife's a big Kindle reader. I'm not. I read today an article about 20 and 30-year-olds and how many they're reading a book a week, and it's online. And what a neat thing for literacy in America to be able to have new ways. You know, it still comes down to content, but it's neat that there are more ways to look at things now. You're always probably in our lifetime going to have people that want to pick up and hold something that was printed. But, you know, with the environmental push on paper and green energy and all that, I'm not saying there's not a footprint from digital houses around the world, but online stuff is going to be efficient. I've been blown away the fact that someone in Australia or England can buy Salem Six or Hong Kong Deception or any of these books we're talking about, and within 1 minute have it on their you know, as a Kindle or a Nook product. It blows my mind, and I think it's just neat that I think it's a good thing for literacy, because it still comes down, people want good quality content. So I'm all for all the platforms.
Well, I'm going to ask John Thompson a question, but first I'm just going to frame it for you. One of the things that I've noticed when I read my books through Kindle is this. I never know if I'm halfway through the book or not. When I open up a hardcover book, I know it. I can visually say, oh, you know, I only have a half of this book. Go, I'm going to make it. I'm going to rush through this book. Now, because of your writing and because of Jack's story, it was a page turner. So whether or not I could tell it was halfway through it or three quarters of the way, it didn't matter. But what is your take as an artist, as a true writer who's always grooming himself and improving your craft? How do you feel about that? Has anyone else noticed that by any chance? You know, halfway through the book?
Well, actually, I was going to say there is a little bar that you can, if you punch your Kindle with your finger, at least if you, a generation, even it was on the generation one as well, if you hit the book, hit the screen with your finger, it opens up a little bar on the underside of the screen, on the bottom of the screen, that shows you how far you are through the book, percentage-wise.
After all these years. I never knew that.
But I want to say one thing about books. I love independent bookstores, and so I am, and I love e-books, and I love them for different reasons. I mean, if you go into an independent bookstore or a great Barnes and Noble, you can sift through books and you can open them up and read them and. Just kind of sample them in ways that it's much harder to do with an ebook. You can do it. You can still read free chapters and whatnot, but there's something about sniffing it and feeling it and holding it. On the other hand, if you encounter a writer for the first time and their book costs $27, you're probably less likely to take a risk on that author, even though you've read great reviews and other people seem to like them. You're less likely to take a chance than you are probably buying an ebook, which is going to be priced from $7.99 to $10.99 or something. And it's a lot less money out of your pocket, and therefore probably something that you're more likely to try on an experimental basis. So for those of us who aren't Patterson or Stephen King or something like that, Baldacci, it's great for us because, you know, people will pick our book up and try it out, and when they like it, they'll buy the next one, and it'll still be the same price. But, you know, and our books are also available through bookstores, but while I love bookstores, I think that it's probably critical for the reading public today, or for the writing public, for the writers who are trying to become discovered, to have the ability to have ebooks.
You know, you've raised so many thoughtful issues here, and I'm sure Jack Sherry and I all have a little take on that. But just in summary then, you know, they're very distinct audiences. There's the end authors, and that ebooks does kind of wrestle away the issue of risk for the reader, for the purchaser. They're able to spend, you know, get out of the gates maybe at $8.99 to $10, and losing that or not feeling, you know, that it was a smart purchase, whatever, that we can walk away with. But when you start moving into the $30 range, you might hesitate. That's a very, very important aspect to the book business. And Sherry, I know that time is precious to you. It's precious to all of us. But as we kind of conclude this conversation, I'd like you to help me with what are your final thoughts on your work and experience with a book building?
Well, I live for it. I love what I do. I get to work with incredible authors like Jack and John, and it's what I live for. So I just ask your listeners to give Salem 6 a try and go to booksbyjohnthompson.com and check out everything that John has to offer, and let us know what you think.
Absolutely, absolutely. I'm very grateful you joined us. And now, John, I have another question for you. John, I know that you are, we've talked about the other books, but you're responsible for working with Jack to create the second in the trilogy. What's the name of the next book for after Salem 6? or in the Salem Six series?
Okay, you got me as a deer in the headlights right
here. Oh,
darling. I don't know yet. Jack?
Well, I think it's a good deer in the headlights because I don't know if the... John, I don't know if we'll have the say in the actual name.
Okay.
But I think the process is going to be, I'm starting to work on it now, and we have the outline done. John's taking a look at that. I had the good fortune of meeting with John last summer in Charleston, which is in some ways actually reminds me of New England because the old on the ocean. And we sat in his den or living room, and we just, part of the team was doing it, some others, we started talking about the next book. And I think one reason why the process works with us is John used the word thematic. You know, if you can thematically understand, to me it's the story. If I can see in my head the characters and the whole story from start to finish, and John would be better to speak to me than this. I think every writer is different. I mean, I've been asked, when do you write? What time of day are you creative? How do you write?
Mm.
I kind of get it in my head. If I can get something in my head, whether it's trying to climb a mountain or write a book or do anything, I can kind of get through it. If I don't see it and feel it in my head, I can't. So the next book is, you know, it's a continuation of the story, where we left it. A lot of people, like Sherry said, want to know what happens because we kind of left it on that nice note. And frankly, the story needs to continue because there was good energy to the story, and we're not forcing it. So John Andrews continues after the first book, and his life still is just recovering because our book is a tight timeline of just a few weeks in his life. And it's a continuation of the relationship with his daughter and, you know, the surviving characters and the ongoing battle with the historical forces going on in his life and the coven. And some neat stuff of Salem is in the next book, where more of Nathaniel Hawthorne, who I just think is such a great figure, and the House of Seven Gables, and there might be, just a little hint for your listeners, there might be a play on, you know, the evil in the House of Six, which is a change of the House of Seven, and we'll explain why the seventh gable was added to this famous American house. And the first book, of course, Salem Six, so the original six judges. So there might be a continuation of that theme, and that's probably as far as I'll go now.
Well, gentlemen, you're both deer in the headlights. Seem to be reasonable response as far as I'm concerned. John, I want to throw another question out to you. I promise, hopefully it's not going to take you by surprise. But when you look back and you think about the work that you're doing, all the works that you have created all seem to be thrillers, very fast moving. And listeners, I want you to know when you read this book, you will feel this book. It goes so fast. The plot moves fast. There's a lot of, you can actually feel what the character is feeling. You went to great pains to describe the sounds in this book. And I'm wondering, how do you get psyched enough and create those sound pictures on the pages of your books?
Well, when I write a scene, I try to imagine all of the senses that would be engaged. And so some of them are smell, and some of them they could be taste, but they probably aren't taste as much. But certainly sound is huge. You know, if you're walking through a cavern or a cavernous dark place that's kind of maze-like, it's deep underground, and there certainly is a scene like that in Salem Six, the sound of your footsteps is something that will echo and kind of roll off into the distance, and it becomes really part of the spookiness of the place. And so if you don't write those things in, I think you're not taking advantage of all the opportunities to make the scene as powerful and as much fun as it could be.
Well, you know, Jack is a well-known radio personality. Jack, I'm going to shout out your own website, too. It's jackheathradio.com. So sound means the world to people interested in radio, who create radios, radio shows, and who listen to radio. So, Jack, what do you think about the sounds of Salem Six?
Well, I think I can't say better than what John said in terms of, like, you know, deep areas. To me, it's probably more of thing, and I like how he talked about the footsteps. But to me, it's really storytelling and putting someone in a place and having enough detail or narrative in the writing, or if it's talking about the radio. I mean, I don't want to get into politics here, but, you know, certain people can speak and tell a story, even if they're making a factual point. They can kind of paint the picture, I guess, is the simplest cliche to use. And I, it's funny, I kind of write the way I, and you're a radio, you have a great show, Leanne, and when I'm a radio host, I kind of do what John said. I kind of close my eyes a lot. It's probably a good thing I'm not doing a TV radio show, because I try and put myself in someone's living room, a car, or a workspace, and talk directly to them. I used to say in the television news business to reporters, you're not talking to 100 or 200 people in a room. That's really hard. You're really talking to 1.5 people usually. So I try and, you know, just story tell. And when I write, my style is reporter type, you know, factual. You know, she was 5'6", 126 pounds. And I just, to me, it's the same kind of discipline and getting better, trying to get better and better at it.
Well, I have to tell you, both of you, that this book has really led the way for people to revisit their understanding of history. It may be fiction. I think that's how it's branded. But I think the bigger issues together, you crafted a wonderful work and world to investigate, read the book, and rethink history. Now, John, are there any final thoughts, perhaps, that you'd like to share with us before we close out our show on Courage Cocktail Radio?
I would just like to thank you. This has been a really wonderful interview, and you've given us an opportunity to showcase our book. And I'm deeply appreciative of that, Leanne, and I hope that your readers take a chance on us and give the book a try, and then go to www.booksbyjohnthompson.com and check out what else I've written. And if you have children, 8 to 15-year-old kids, take a look at The Girl from Felony Bay coming in April. But thank you so much for giving us this time.
Well, it's been our privilege. Jack, are there any final thoughts for you? Can we do a shout-out for your book one more time?
Well, no, it's always just great to be on with John because we don't live all that close together, and hope he's doing well and look forward to our next book, Salem 6. Rebecca's Rising, our first one, and it's only been out a few months. It's doing great, so check it out. Salem Witch Trilogy, salemwitchtrilogy.com is a pretty cool, entertaining website for the book and the series. And I just thank you, like John said, for what you're doing. Your show should be heard around the world. It's a great way to get authors and stories out there, so thank you. And I hope everyone enjoys the holiday season. And if they want to take their mind off all the stress, it's like I said, my radio show and our handheld instant communication society, and chill out and escape, they can travel with John Andrews in the book and enjoy it.
Terrific. You know, I'm so grateful you joined us. Sherry, I don't know how to thank her. Her insight is invaluable as a publisher of Salem 6. She has left us in the conversation, moving on to another appointment. So I'm grateful to you
please
all.
Please note, Leanne, that the authors did not skip out on you. It was the publisher and the marketing person. John and I stayed with you right to the bitter end.
Well, I have to tell you, she was a little bit nervous about the timing of this. She's running some kind of a webinar that I'm sure she's going to use to promote your book, gentlemen. So if there were one person to skip out, I think she's got your interest in her heart.
Oh, always. Yeah.
She's done a terrific job for us, and appreciated.
I'm so thrilled. Now, gentlemen, thanks so much. I am going to ask you to plan on revisiting me in Courage Cocktail. Bring book two with you as soon as that's out, or a few months before it's out, so that we can carry on this conversation.
Absolutely.
Thanks,
Leanne. We'd both love to do it. And Jack, thank you. But thank you, everyone.
Very good.
Thank you. Take care.
Thanks. Well, listeners, I hope you've enjoyed today's program. Of course, it was a Halloween special. But as you learned, the things that are scariest are often not those of the spectral world, but rather those of the world that kind of reveal hypocrisy and avarice and some of the things that make us imperfectly human. So I hope you've enjoyed it. I want to thank you all. Our show is reaching more supporters thanks to your contributions to WCOM-FM. Today marks the 56th show of this program series, and we're very grateful to have the opportunity to showcase local talent as well as broader talent. I want to thank our sponsor, the Triangle Swim School, for renewing their sponsorship for this upcoming year. The Triangle Swim School is based in the Triangle Aquatic Center in Cary, North Carolina. Their website is www.triangleswimschool.com. The radio show that precedes Courage Cocktail, if you get here early, is Ernie's Hoods, and the name of the show is Radio in Vivo, and it airs every Wednesday at 11 o'clock to 12 noon. If you get here early, you can tune in and learn more about Ernie's work and learn more about the science in the pipeline here at the RTP, Research Triangle Park, and the Chapel Hill Raleigh area. I want to give special thanks to our sound engineer and board operator, Bill. Thank you all for joining us next week. Yes, we will be broadcasting on Halloween, but our focus, given the momentum of the presidential election, is going to be a program based on the Board of Elections. I'll be examining the way we vote here. Now, listeners, if you're local, if you're not so local, don't worry. The point of next week's program is to help us all find the websites, find the information that we need before we enter that, before we vote. I'm grateful for you joining to me today and look forward to being with you next week. You bring the lunch and I'll bring the Courage Cocktail. You are listening to WCOMLP, Chapel Hill, Carrboro, North Carolina.